Session number 10420, reel 36.
Colonel W.I. Watson, reel 36. The battalion or the brigade was taken out and put into Army Reserve, Colonel.
Yes, that was what took place. Now, this was the 28th, I think, of October, 4 days after the zero day, 24th, and already the advance parties of the 69th Brigade were in our lines reconnoitering for the takeover. However, we all wondered what our role was to be. And at dusk that night, section by section crept out of the positions in the line, and the whole battalion assembled on the well away from the reverse slope and had a meal. And it was obviously anything would be welcome change to what the condition under the conditions we had being living in. Well, in the early hours of the next morning, the 29th of October, we got embarked in MT under the Corps Prevost, and we moved from one end of the Alamein line, southern end, to the northern end in the Prevost, in these transports under the help of the Corps Prevost, who were very good indeed. And the whole route had little tiny lights from beginning to end. And we eventually got to an area near Amayed Station, which was on the railway, the coast railway. And we were by the sea. It was such a well-organized move. And these little lights guided us the whole way. And it was really delightful because there was soft sand which we could sleep on. We got there at 3 in the morning, and every chap just doffed down in the soft sand. And next day, they were able to go and have a bathe. Still, we never knew what our role was going to be. We had no idea. We were told that we were definitely in the New Zealand Division, and that we had left the 50th Division. And we always had advance parties, always ready to move, to go under brigade guidance or to a new area. I mean, they were always earmarked, ready to move at very short notice. However, we were told that there would be no move until the morrow. We thought we would be off from the soft sand area somewhere or other, but we weren't. We were told we would, wouldn't be moving until the morrow, and therefore we had yet another night in sleeping on soft sand and having a bathe. But not knowing what's going to happen and what your fate, one's fate is to be, you know, hangs heavily. I think it hung heavily on us all, because, as I say, we were only three companies and we were only half trained. However, on the next day, the 30th of October, advance parties left in the middle of the afternoon. And at about tea time, the brigadier unfolded his plan for Operation Supercharge, which was to take place the next night, supported by every available gun in the 8th Army, That is to say, there were 13 field regiments and 3 medium regiments. Now, the plan was to attack on a 4,000-yard front by the 51st Durham Brigade and the 152nd Highland Brigade. And the objective was to be the Abdel Rahman track, which was the way ahead in the enemy's positions. Now, that track was very conspicuous because it was on a slight rise and it had telephone poles all the way running all the way down it. It ran from the sea, you might say, or from the coast road down towards the Katara Depression. That was to be the objective. And our arch enemies were to the 90th Light, German 90th Light Division, and the guns were to fire, the old guns were to fire well ahead of the advancing troops. The newer guns were to fire just in front of them. And of course, the medium guns would fire even further. Bofa guns were to fire tracer down each flank to guide us. There were to be 22 lifts before, you might say, half time. At half time, there'd be a lull for half an hour after we'd got about halfway. And the role of the 6th Battalion was in reserve. The 8th and 9th were to be in the leading companies. And when we got to the line of 7 dug-in self-propelled guns or tanks, we were to do a right-hand swing and face northwards. And we were to be the north, facing northwards of this bridgehead. The guns, these guns had been imposed on our maps so we could see where they were. And when we got to them, we were to do this quite remarkable swing northwards. And then whole of the artillery barrage would restart after half an hour to help the 8th and 9th Battalion to get onto the Sidi Abdel Rahman track.
Do you recall the timetable for this? How long was it to take to get to the halfway stage?
I can't remember how long it was to take to the halfway stage. So there were, I think I'm right in saying, 22 lifts.
That's lifts of artillery.
Yeah. And on each lift, the Beaufort gun fired a tracer. And the distance was, I'm not sure how far we had to walk. But I know that after we'd done 800 yards, we got a lot of enemy machine gun fire from our right flank. We should have advanced about 2,500 yards.
The dug-in guns on which you were to do your turn.
What?
The dug-in guns on which you were to do your turn.
Yes.
Were they ahead of you? Would be dug in when you got there? Were they?
Yes, because they'd been seen from the air, and the map people had imposed them on our maps.
Were they enemy guns? Were they German guns?
Enemy guns. Yes, enemy Italian. Self-propelled, or some of them may have been tanks, as far as I know. But my chaps dealt with them in no uncertain terms. That was it. We did about 2,000 odd yards, and we did it exactly almost. Well, anyhow, that was the plan, roughly the plan. That Brigadier Josh Percy told us that we were to do would be carried out the next night. and supported by every gun, as I say, in the 8th Army. However, as is recorded in all the histories, that the attack was delayed for 24 hours. And that morning, we had another conference, and we were told that we would have the support of some New Zealand machine gunners, and by Jove, they were good, and a Māori battalion just on my right flank. The CEO of the Māori battalion, incidentally, was killed.
Can I just ask you there, Colonel? What were your feelings and the feelings of the battalion had been postponed 24 hours after the
Well, it was always rather a nuisance, but it undoubtedly gave us time. Now, what we had to do was to move, when we did, that particular night, we moved forward in thick dirt and dust and sand to an area closer to where we were going to start from for doing the attack. And it was a wretched move forward because there were minefields all over the place, and you could hardly see the little lights because the vehicles created fearful sand and dust and dirt. But we moved forward to an area nearer, and there I expected to find a place to turn in and a place ascertained by the advance parties who had gone forward, and so that we could turn in and occupy it and go to sleep again, rest. However, there was an interminable delay, and I went forward to met the brigade major, and he said, there is no, you'll just have to make, the best of the bad job and pull off the track and doss down for the night, which we duly did, and it was a very uncomfortable night. However, we got in there and sorted ourselves out, but all round us were minefields and vehicles and tanks and other vehicles waiting for the gap to be made so that they could get out and get forward into and start chasing the Germans.
So you were among the chasing element?
Yes, the chasing element. Yes, for that night. And then, as is recorded, the battle was put off for 24 hours. And so we were there the next day. During the course of the afternoon, I went forward with my intelligence officer, Jerry Mansell, and my second-in-command, Dominic Parker. And we went forward to the start line. And the start line for our attack had been marked out by oil drums, big oil drums. They'd been surveyed in, I suppose, by the sappers. And there they were. And all the Australians had been pulled out. There was nobody in the front line. The Australians had all been pulled out because the shells were going to drop on the front line. And subsequently, after dusk, my good Jerry Mansell, the intelligence officer, and the intelligence officers of the other battalions under the brigade intelligence officer taped the line with white tape. It's no good doing it in daylight, but it would be seen from the air. So they did it in when dusk fell, and they also taped some of the route up to the start line. Now, on the way back, I had a very near squeak. Some Stukas came over, German Stukas, which were rare birds, you might say then. Our Air Force predominated, in the American Air Force. and they peeled off and really were aiming to dive bomb some gun positions close at hand, but they weren't very good, and one dropped extremely close to us. I would hardly believe it, but I could see the splinters of the bomb scudding through the sand, in the sand. And my good driver, Parkinson, just drove like a Jehu, swung off the road, and we all tumbled into the ditch. And as we lay there, an ambulance passed us, and the driver was covered in blood. It went over a little rise, and after the alarm was all over, the guns were never touched. After it was all over and the Stukas had flown away, we went over the rise, and there was the ambulance driver. Every bit of flesh off at the top of his hands had been removed to the bones, and the passenger next to him was dead, and the a sitting casualty had been shot again, hit again through the shoulder, and I don't know what the other wounded fellows in it, whether they were alive or dead or not, but it was a terribly near squeak for us. Anyhow, I got back, and I'd seen where we were going to. Then, on the 1st of November, the next day, in the afternoon, we moved to a concentration area very near Teralisa station. Teralisa means in Arabic the little hill of Jesus. And we moved there, and we had our last meal. And we all had ammunition dished to us, of course, handed out to us. And we had to hand in all our private letters and papers and documents and note cases, and they were put into sandbags. And tied up and kept by the quartermaster, hopefully for our return, so that the enemy would not gain any information which might be of use to him. And just as the sun had set, at 7 o'clock, we set off for our 5-mile march to the start line. It was a sticky night, and as we passed Teralisa station, it would be about 7:30, and it was known as Diamond Track that we marched along. There were vehicles passing us the whole time, and on our right, I could see in the dark, there was a minefield, and there were some New Zealand gunners, I think they were. Anyhow, there were some gunners there, stripped to the waist, sweating like anything, and they were pumping in shells into their guns. So you can imagine what the noise was like as we passed. They were making a diversion to what was known as Thompson's Post. Thompson's Post was held by the Australians, and they were making a diversion to draw the enemy's attention away from what was going to happen later in the night. It was a nasty, unpleasant march, because, as I say, it was extremely sticky. And there was a most horrible smell of death. You could see corpses lying on the minefield wire, and that sort of thing. And eventually, we got there and we had roughly 2 hours. We had to be there by 10 o'clock. We got there between 9:30 and 10 to allow the tanks and our own carriers and anti-tank guns to get up to come behind us in readiness to pass through the gap. Now, after we'd done the attack, there were New Zealand sappers behind us, and they were going to make a gap through the minefield, all the minefields, so that all these vehicles, tanks, anti-tank guns, carriers, and what have you, could come up and to try and push their way, so far as the tanks were concerned, and get out into the open.
How was it intended that the other two battalions and yourself would get through the minefield? Did you just walk through them?
We walked through them. I was coming to it. We just walked through them. We had to be there by 10. So we had a 2.5 hour, as it were, 2.5 hour wait. And of course, we were only in khaki drill. It was in November. And it was a pretty chilly, it was a pretty chilly wait. So the good Jerry Mansell checked the compasses with the company commanders, with their compasses. He got in touch with the 8th and 9th Battalion, and every man just lay down and rested. And gradually the noise went down, the noise of battle ceased, and in the end it became deathly silent. And very occasionally, way down in the dark, you could hear machine gun, sputter of a machine gun. And very occasionally, a very light went up. But otherwise, it was absolutely silent. There was the tape waiting for us. I did try to get a wink of sleep, but I couldn't get to sleep because, well, there's a certain responsibility that rests on your shoulders. I always told any new chaps who'd never been in battle before, I told them that we would be thinking about them when they're going into battle. But the one thing they must do is to keep themselves occupied. If things are going nasty, they must keep themselves occupied and don't sit and think. Do something. And that is so true, you know. If you think about it, sit and think and don't get on with doing the job, you will fail.
Must have been a very difficult 2 hours, lying quietly.
Yes, well, there was nothing we weren't being fired at. There were no Australians there. And it was just a question of waiting.
Going through your mind for those two hours?
Oh, yes. All sorts of things went through my mind, it was particularly cold, in khaki drill and shorts and that sort of thing. A word about Jerry Mansell. Jerry Mansell, I think, was in the Norfolk Regiment, really, and he was quite brilliant. His mother was French, so he could talk French. And I had an intelligence sergeant, too, who could talk German. And Jerry Mansell, after the war, became director of outside broadcasting for the BBC. I was a well-known character in the BBC after the war. And he was my IO. But anyhow, we're back on now, we're waiting. And at about 12:15 or thereabouts, a rum ration was issued. And we put the headquarters rum jar was put on top of one of the oil drums nearby, and I often wonder how long it sat there. But I can see it now being solemnly put on top, empty of course, put on top of one of the oil drums. Now that would be about 12:15. Now at 12:40, everybody stood up and shuffled into the, put on, got their equipment right, and got their magazines charged. I knew I loaded my revolver, and throughout the advance I carried it in my hand, in case of I had to use it quickly. And then another thing you heard was click, 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 as the chaps put their bayonets on. At 5 minutes to one, we started to walk slowly forward. It was all silent. We walked through the minefields. I think I had one chap killed. I'm not sure. I can't remember. But I had practically no casualties at all. We walked right through the minefields. And then at 5 minutes past one, every gun opened up. And the shells came screaming over our heads. And the Bofors started to fire to keep its direction. I can remember hearing the pipers from the Highlanders. And next day when I was wandering about the battlefield, I found a set of pipes. And I returned them to whatever regiment it was, I can't remember now. But 25 pounders don't thump when you're hearing the shells go over. They like a whiplash. And it was nerve-wracking to start with. But then the whole thing started to be like a song. The shells were just coming over and exploding ahead of us. And within